What's up, party people? It's me, Sarah G, with the smack, and I'm back. I am a CFA charter holder, and I used to be a financial advisor. On this podcast, I provide non-BS-oriented, straight-up views on LinkedIn and other financial advisor marketing topics. You can't get this anywhere else, people. So if that's of value, then please subscribe. And if not, then please leave this podcast right now. Hey, what's up, y'all financial advisors? So, you know, on this podcast, we always talk about marketing. Well, there is a very important change in regulation coming up, but, you know, you always get it better from the compliance people. So I have three of them here today, not just one, but three compliance officials here today to beat you up on this podcast in advance of the new marketing regulation taking hold. I'm so excited to hear from them. They are John Ivan, Andrew Lippman, and Richard Chen. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello, Sarah.
Hello.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi. So can each of you just go around and introduce yourselves in two sentences or less? I have your bios here, but they're kind of lawyerish and I don't want to bore the audience. Sorry.
I will go first. After 30 plus years of being compliance and in-house legal, I'm now consulting, always on the advisory wealth management side and very much so in the independent channel space with new RIAs or small RIAs.
And that's great. And what's your firm called, John?
I'm at Capital Forensics. We're based out of Chicago. We also do a lot of capital forensics data analytics whenever firms need help with what maybe regulators are saying about their numbers or things like that.
Good to know. Hopefully no one on this podcast listening will ever need that, but
exactly.
Good to know.
Just
my goodness, you're scared.
Just
like
in case.
I can feel my blood pressure rising here. Okay, great. And Andrew, you're next.
Hi, my name is Andrew Lippman. I am also with Capital Forensics with John, and I've been in the industry about 35 years. John and I have crossed paths at other places, and I work with organizations to help with change and to manage change both from an operational execution and understanding issues levels. So it covers a wide gamut of things, including gnarly things like this kind of rule.
Right. Great. And there's Richard.
Go ahead, Richard. Hi. I'm Rich Chen. I'm the founder of Richard L. Chen PLLC, which is a law firm practice that is devoted to serving investment advisors, including wealth managers, private fund sponsors, and service providers. We provide a wide range of legal and compliance services to the RIA industry, including compliance program development, implementation, mock audits, SEC exam work. And we also do a lot of work on the transactional side, whether it's forming entities, you know, M&A transactions, succession planning, and fund formation. And I've been in the industry about 25 years, practiced at a number of large firms in New York, and just glad to be here.
Yeah, glad to have you.
Thank you.
So, what
I was just going to add as a fun fact that not to be intimidated, but I think you, Richard and Sarah, you both were Harvard alumni, right?
I'm only a single H, though. Richard's a double H.
No.
This is great. It's always fun to be on with another Harvard alum too. So.
I usually don't like Harvard people, but it sounds like you might actually be the first Harvard person that I like. Okay, so this is an inaugural day for me. Because I hope no one's listening to this I used to go to college with, but if you are, you know why I'm saying that, okay? So thanks. Now, so let's get into it, shall we? There's a new SEC marketing rule taking hold, and that's where I'm going to stop talking about it. Okay, so somebody else talk now.
Yeah. So there's a lot of excitement. It's a new frontier for advertising and marketing for investment advisors. The SEC is passing a rule, or has just adopted a rule that will come into effect on May 4th that will allow advisors a lot more freedom to market their services. By eliminating some of the rules that previously stymied advertising by advisors that other industries get to enjoy, like sharing testimonials and endorsements from clients and others they work with, or citing to your past specific profitable recommendations without having to list all of the recommendations that you've had for the past year. The rule does come with a host of new things that need to be considered, including the expansion of what is considered to be an advertisement, which now includes not only what we traditionally think of as advertising, but also any commentary basically with respect to testimonials or endorsements. But it also collapses in the existing cash solicitation rule, which covers arrangements between advisors and those who solicit clients on behalf of advisors and folds certain requirements that used to be set aside in the separate rule into the new marketing rule. And we can talk about
that. Hold on, Richard. Hold on.
Okay. It's a lot.
That's a lot there. Yeah. That's a higher level. Let's just pause and kind of go one by one, okay, sure. And teach those things. So Richard, you just gave that summary. So either Andrew or John, can you jump in and kind of flesh that out a little bit for me?
Yeah, let's talk, first of all, the ex-compliance, chief compliance officer speaking here now. Before everybody gets excited about that April, May, and wants to start running out, then the actual compliance effective date is later, and people think it's as maybe the fourth quarter of or at a later time. So the early
hold on, can I want to just go back over that a little bit, please? That's very important for people to understand.
So you have to put the rule is effective now, but what
effective on May 4th.
Yeah, but what regulators do is they say, here's this new rule, it's effective this date, but they're always very nice. They give you a heads up and a warning, because all of the chief compliance officers or compliance officers all around listening to this podcast who go, there's no way I can change all my rules and be ready for this that early. So there's an effective date, and then there's the what they call the compliance date. And I think it's always set in a weird way. Richard knows this better than I do. It's like X number of days after the publication. But I think people are generally saying the late third quarter, fourth quarter of 2022. Richard?
November 4th,
2022?
Yeah.
You got to remember, this is taking an entire set of rules. This is why it's so big. It's taking an entire set of rules that were written with a chisel and a hammer back in the eight days, and everybody's been living. All the investment advisors have been living by these rules for so long. This is completely changing a lot of them, and we'll talk about it. And some of them came up and were rules, and they were really easy. You can't do this, can't do that, can't do this. We'll talk about it. Others were esoteric, no action guidance, which we'll talk about. They actually took those away. This is really big. This doesn't happen a lot. This is big.
But we're talking about like a year and a half from now, yes. Compliance actually being able to give their advisors the green light.
Correct. No, you can start to, as of the effective date, utilize some of the freedom provided by the new marketing rule. The catch is that once you start to take advantage of that new freedom, you have to come into full compliance with the marketing rule. And that is what John is saying. There is a lot involved in what someone has to do in order to come into compliance. And so that's one of the considerations.
Right. That's the big deal, is that the rule is actually attractive. Attractive in the sense there are things that financial advisors probably have always wanted to do that now the rule will allow them to do. But like anything that comes along, it's a zero-sum game. There's good stuff and there's bad stuff. The bad stuff is the things that they have to do to comply with the rule. So people are going to want to get ahead of it because they're going to see things they're going to want to do. But that then it gets what Richard was saying, is they want to do it, then they have to meet the obligations of the rule as well. They can't just take the icing off the cake.
Okay. There's
mud?
Now,
it's always a catch.
We wanted to touch into some.
I feel like I'm like talking to my estate attorney about my role here in this thing. And it's funny because I'm such a badass that I always am like, it's like I have other badasses on this podcast and the conversation is always so direct. It's like, yes, do this. No, don't do that. Like, it's clear, you know, but I understand why that this is complicated. And so just one thing I want to say to everybody listening to this is that these gentlemen are wonderful, but this is not your compliance officer either. Well, in some cases it may be if you have your clients listening to this, but please folks, please consult your legal team and your compliance officer before taking any kind of action at all. Okay. And don't just go by what we're saying here. I just have to say that as a disclaimer. Okay.
Yeah. And Sarah, that's a really important point. Hopefully at the end of this, we'll open some eyes at the good and the dangerous stuff about this rule. And people will take action and either contact your compliance officer, your counsel, or us, Richard or John, myself, and reach out and find out more about it so that you can get in compliance, because it's going to be really important.
Right. Okay. So let's go over the five important areas. Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
So we're going to talk about the opportunities and an explanation of these, and then we're going to talk about the risks. So the first one would be testimonials.
So this is probably the part of the rule that advisors are most excited about, the opportunity to present, you know, comments from clients and, you know, existing fund investors, if they have a fund, about the advisor and their experience with the advisor, or, you know, for those who aren't clients, to provide what they call an endorsement now, which is a statement of approval or experience with the advisor that the person has had. In the past, that has been prohibited, but now there's a lot more freedom to engage in, you know, communications that those folks provide that, you know, can really shed light on, you know, what the advisors like to work with. That's the positive part. And, you know, John will talk about the fact that there are a lot of requirements that come along with that.
Absolutely. And by the way, from a compliance officer's perspective, this was always kind of the easy part, you know, no testimonials, no, it's a big no. And it was always how big is the no, and, you know, on that. And but you were always starting from that point of view. So actually a number of at the firms, not only the advisors who would want to use this, but the compliance folks and the supervisors who actually have to approve it now have to understand the rules around it. One of the things that the SEC is always all about disclosure, and I'm sure Richard's going to talk about it throughout. They're always about disclosure. So what the testimonial and the old cash solicitation are kind of combined into a new thing, but it does take some components of the old cash solicitation rule, and that is that you have to have an agreement. There's got to be fair. Everybody's got to understand it. You have to have a record keeping about it, and then you have to have disclosures. So it's not. It's not like some of the, you know, the testimonials that you'll see on TV, on the betting sites and things like that. It's going to be a controlled environment. Richard, is that fair way to say it?
I think that's exactly right. So the SEC cares, as John said, about disclosure. What do they care that's disclosed? They care that the audience knows who's providing the testimonial or endorsement, if they have a reason for promoting the advisor, right? If there's a conflict, and if they're getting paid, what are they getting paid? They'd actually have to disclose that, right? So, and then as John said, there are some oversight elements with respect to the fact that an advisor has an obligation to make sure that the person who's providing the commentary, whether it's a testimony or endorsement, has a reasonable basis for the statements that they're making. And then, as John said, that if you're getting paid, you have to have an agreement in place with the person who is being paid, and to make sure that the person is not statutorily disqualified, meaning that they are been found to have engaged in, you know, various criminal conduct or been sanctioned by regulators.
And Richard, holy, I would just also add the whole thing about testimonials, with not just cherry picking.
Yes.
The biggest part, the process has to be sort of like Google. When people leave restaurant reviews, you can get good and bad ones.
Yeah. Yeah. The good part is that they said you don't have to present an equal number of good and bad statements about the advisor in order to be balanced, but you will have to make sure your disclaimers are beefed up to say something to the fact that this may not be necessarily representative of all of my clients' experiences or all the people who know me and have something to say about me.
What really scares me about this is the fact that there are some, and usually it's like an RIA firm, one of these independent firms that just, right, like doesn't see the need to have a compliance officer. The broker dealers are so heavily regulated that they ain't getting by with nothing, right? But some of these RIA firms just, you know, independent, there's like two people there. They don't have a compliance officer in-house, but they don't outsource it either. The only time some of these firms consult a lawyer is like when there's documentation needed for something, when there's a real serious kind of a thing, and they're just doing self-compliance. And so I feel as if these firms should not attempt this on their own, because I'm scared for them.
I think that's absolutely right, Sarah. I think one of the things that John, Andrew, and I are trying to portray is this is an attractive opportunity for advisors, but it comes with a whole lot of strings attached. And people have to be aware that the SEC will be scrutinizing this in exams, in their reviews, in Form ADV. Now you'll be required to disclose more about your advertising practices. They fully intend to make sure that advisors are not taking advantage of the freedom that's being given here.
Okay.
The whole trend of all the rules, whether it's the SEC rule for best interest or this rule or the former DOL rule and the new DOL rule, is giving clients the information so that they can make an informed decision. And advertising, as it normally is thought of both giving people information, but also in a sort of a conflicted way, because you always want to make yourself better than you are. And that's where the SEC really wants to keep the guardrails up. So as Richard said, it comes with those strings, and those strings are to make sure the client can make informed decisions.
Okay.
And that's where it gets dangerous.
Right. Okay, folks, let's move on to the cash solicitation rule, the second tenant here we're going to be discussing.
Yeah. Well, do you want to do it, John? Go ahead.
No, go ahead. It's actually in the first rule with the testimonial. They smashed them into one.
Yeah, that's right. So as John had sort of highlighted some of those issues, they folded the cash solicitation rule, and that will go away. But the requirements of the cash solicitation rule will predominantly stay in place, meaning that an advisor will still need to have an agreement with the solicitor. The good news is that they are removing a very onerous requirement that requires the advisor to obtain an acknowledgement from the client that that they receive disclosures about the conflicts the solicitor has and the compensation that the solicitor receives. However, another piece of good news is that the agreement requirement will go away with respect to those arrangements where there's less than $1,000 in value at stake with respect to the compensation. So, you know, advisors who want clients who, you know, get a token gift or something to promote them won't have to enter an agreement. The bad part, though, is that it expands the type of compensation to cover not only cash compensation, but anything that's of not other value, non-cash compensation that someone could receive that creates an incentive to promote the advisor. So it does expand it in that respect.
Okay, hold on a second. So if I have a financial advisor on my podcast and they say, oh, just because you put me on your podcast, I would love to forward this out on my newsletter and my social media, and I get a client from that, let's say, is that a violation? See, that's where it gets to me interesting.
So if there, it's really focused on whether there's, most of it focuses, the requirements focus on whether or not there's actually compensation received, like, or a benefit to the person who's making the referral or a positive statement about the advisor and whether they're not. And the SEC recognized, hey, there are a lot of opportunities for folks who just really do want to promote the advisor, and the advisor may be giving them something nominal in value. They don't want to regulate those too much, other than to, you know, have the disclosures that, you know, hey, I might have an incentive, but they don't want those folks to have an agreement in place or be subject to, you know, certain disqualification provisions. I mean, you know, they don't want to heavily regulate those types of arrangements. Although I will say that they do want to regulate arrangements with lead generation firms and others who, you know, specifically do matchmaking or lead generation for advisors. Those will be regulated under the new marketing rule as compensation arrangements requiring compliance.
Well, not sure a lot of those work anyways, but that's another podcast. I've already raked that one over the coals a few times. Okay, John, do you want to talk about the risks of this down with the cash solicitation rule?
So say two things. Number one is you have to make sure you have the components in place. The good news was you can say there's no more cash, you know, solicitation rule, but unfortunately it's a bigger rule. It's a compensation rule and it's folded in with the testimonial rule. So really it, other than the ability to get some de minimis arrangements where the rules don't come into play at all, it is a little bit of a sort of a fig leaf to say the cash solicitation rule went away. It just came back in another form with the testimonial rule. Yes, they did have an ability to have certain sort of one-offs with no compensation, you know, go away, but the rule's still there. It's just a different rule.
Now, this next one is huge. Number three, moving to a principle-based approach versus a rules-based approach. And it's so funny that I see this now because I was just talking with a guy from the UK who was saying how different it is in the UK because they go by principles and we go by rules. Now, here I see this here on this podcast. So please explain away, lawyers.
Yeah. So that actually is a really good analogy. I think by and large, our systems are generally more rules-based, although the Advisors Act is a bit more principles-based than a lot of the FINRA rules, I think as Sarah was referencing earlier. But so this is kind of consistent with the approach that the SEC is going with. It's they see that there are certain principles that they want to make sure you abide by, right? Don't put out any false or misleading statements. Make sure you have supporting documentation. If you make statements of material fact, right, that you're not just guessing at something. And the big one is that you make sure that any presentation you provide is fair and balanced, meaning that you can't put all the positive statements about your strategy or your advice on the front page and then basically hide all the disclosures in the back. That won't fly as fair and balanced, right? And then this is obviously going to be a challenge, particularly where you have limited space, like in a social media account or, other sort of limited space to, you know, to really promote your services. But the SEC is, you know, giving opportunities to provide a more layered disclosure where you have balanced benefits and risks that are presented on one page and then perhaps others that are, you know, more in the back. So this does replace the rules-based, you know, approach that prohibited testimonials, prohibited endorsements, you know, restricted significantly your ability to cite to past specific profitable recommendations. But, you know, advisors, again, should be cautious that, this is not complete freedom.
I completely agree. It used to be easy. Models are bad. Back testing is bad. Testimonials are bad. They're no-nos. They're the, as I said before, they're the Ten Commandments chiseled in stone. Easy for the compliance officers. Go on to the next question. Now they're allowed, and you can see in the commentary and the rules because that's where the industry has evolved. People actually, as I think, five or six or seven times it says many institutional investors actually want you to back test something and say, how would you have done? So it is bringing things up to date, making them more relevant today, but with the strings attached that there's these seven guiding principles that are going to really cover everything. And often in the adopter and release, it will say, yeah, you can do this with this specific thing, but remember those seven principles. So you'll always have to come back to the seven principles that apply, even if it looks like you get a little wiggle room somewhere else.
Yeah, and John actually brings up a good point here, because the problem is it's somewhat of a moving target, because the seven principles don't apply across the same way, depending perhaps on your audience, right? As John said, institutional investors might be able to get a bit more information fed to them without certain disclosures that your retail investors, if they saw the same thing, the SEC would think very differently perhaps about whether it's considered fair and balanced.
And I would add, Sarah, to your point before about those RIAs who are not seeking advice of either having a compliance personnel on staff or at Reach, this is where principles versus rules gets difficult, because rules are clear, very bright lines that you can try to stay in. But when it's principle-based, you really need someone objective to then be looking at it, because from where you're coming, you're invested in it, and you may be thinking you're adhering to the principle, but you actually could be breaking the principle. And you may not realize it for a long time. And then by the time the SEC comes in, you'll have this whole history, which you thought you were okay with, that suddenly is really wrong. And that's
unfortunate
why
part, the SEC has 20/20 hindsight, as I think Xander's pointing out.
And they have it in their own lens. And your lens, when it's your own advertising, you think this is all fine, but it's not, or it may not be.
All right. Well, we could talk a lot more about that, I'm sure, but let's move on to the next point, which is performance advertising.
Yeah. So performance advertising, the goal here in terms of consolidating the rules is designed to provide investors with meaningful information, whether it's comparisons based on presentations of gross versus net performance. Now, the SEC has eliminated certain circumstances where you can present only gross performance results and requires net performance results be presented at least with equal prominence as gross performance results. They've also mandated that to the extent that it's applicable to an advisor and his track record, that you have to present 1, 5, and 10-year track records. Obviously, if you have less than that, then it's not applicable. But they want investors to see a meaningfully lengthy period of performance so that it's less likely that it'll be cherry-picked. They have, as John indicated, seemingly relaxed the rules around presentation of hypothetical performance results, which include model backtested and target or projected performance. But they still caution against providing that to audiences where it's clear they won't understand, like in mass produced publications or general publications. So that's the thinking behind the performance presentation rules.
Yeah, there's kind of three themes kind of that cut across a lot of the rule, and that is retail versus institutional audience. I think it was some recognition of that, but probably not as much. I think probably a fair amount of disappointment that there certainly a lot of the commentators, as rules are proposed, this one's, Richard, how long has this proposal been around? But there's a lot of commentary on it. So people were really hoping to, drive a wedge through that institutional retail. They recognize it, but instead of saying, here's a nice, easy rule for you, if it's an institution, you can do this, and if it's retail, you can do that, they direct you back to the seven principles and say, well, you better make sure your audience is, it's tailored to your audience, that it's appropriate for your audience. So it's actually, a little murkier and a little more difficult.
Totally agree.
In some areas, but they did open up a lot of, on the other hand, they did open up a lot of areas. So it's a very much giveth and taketh away rule.
Okay, number 5, adoption and entanglement.
Okay, so this one is one of the challenging aspects of the rule. I think it, one of the most challenging aspects. And it pertains to third-party communications that talk about an advisor. The SEC has said that if an advisor is involved with a third party's communications in some level, that the SEC wants to treat that third party communication as the advisor's own because the advisor is quote unquote entangled with that communication. The other area that the SEC is concerned about with is advisors that adopt materials from third parties as their own. Advisor can't disclaim responsibility and say, well, it simply came from a third party. The advisor now has a responsibility to make sure that that the content of that third party communication is in fact accurate. And so they will again consider that advertising or that communication to be the advisor's own. This has a lot of implications for advisors because they'll need to document how much they're involved in third party communication about the advisor to make sure they're not considered entangled. Or if they adopt a third-party communication, that they keep supporting documentation about the diligence that they did to make sure that that third party's statements are actually true.
And this is one of the areas where you talked about the two or three advisor shops where it can get they actually have to kind of police themselves at the bigger shops. It's okay. Everything has to be done on a firm approved social media site with very, very few exceptions. So they actually try to help out the financial advisors by saying, keep everything over here and we'll figure out all those complicated rules. And if you're adopting or getting entangling in somebody's space, financial advisors can actually rely on the firm and its resources, but it's an important area to, it's a challenging area. Ever since the advent of social media, it's been a challenging area for both the broker-dealer community and investment advisors.
Does this pertain to, for example, third-party websites that review?
Absolutely could. If the advisor is some way able to influence what goes on to that website? Absolutely could.
Yeah, that is one of the important, absolutely important areas, Sarah. And the rule, by the way, did preserve the true independent rating, Morningstar-like functions, and those are exempt. Those true independent rating are exempt from all the rules, but of course the issue is all the ones in between where maybe you're getting involved with their presentation.
I mean, because there are these third party websites that like assign stars to financial advisors and rank them supposedly.
So yeah, and those are third party rankings. So an advisor is not going to be responsible if they don't refer to it or they're not involved with it. But if they refer to it, you know, they have a responsibility to make sure they communicate the third party rating accurately to their audience. And if they somehow are involved with that third party rating, perhaps, you know, for instance, if they paid for it, obviously there's a conflict that the SEC wants advisors to make sure that they disclose. But if advisors are not involved at all or don't refer at all to a third party website that talks about them, there's no obligation there.
But for example, if they are touting that some organization says they're top five FA in Rhode Island, let's say, and they want to put that on their business card and on their advertising on the website, top five FA in Rhode Island, and it turns out that top five is just in terms of, say, assets under management, not under investment results or quality of service, then that could be problematic if there's no disclosure. So they have to understand something about the methodology that they can't just say on top.
Without context. In order for any kind of a third party to website to make a meaningful statement about these advisors, I think they would need information from the advisor.
Right.
Otherwise, it's just based on what they're getting in the filings.
Yeah, and that's where the advisor could be responsible and be quote unquote entangled. And unfortunately, it's a facts and circumstances determination, which unfortunately throughout the rule, I think it appears 43 times in the adopting release, right? It depends on the circumstances as to when there could be a problem.
John, anything else to say about this?
Don't pay money to get those 3-star ratings. That will never work.
Well, you know something.
That's an easy one. That was even before and after.
I mean, I've always kind of been of the opinion of who cares about these so-called awards that these advisors get. It's like the best recommendation you can make, the best thing you could ever do for your marketing is to get your clients to go tell their friends about you. It's not what Investopedia says. It's not what Barron's says. It's not any award that you paid for. Whoops. I wasn't implying anything about what those companies. I'm just saying there are these there are these kind of accolades that advisors pay for. And I did a poll on LinkedIn and it was like, what is the worst kind of brag post that you could possibly make on LinkedIn? Brag about your kids, brag about your company, brag about your education, brag about an award you got. And like the award one, it would got the top, right? So people are tired of hearing it anyways. I don't know, but these advisors, they just get taken for their money, I feel, by these award companies.
Well, it also becomes a bit of an ego thing, a competitive ego thing. You just have to watch out for it because to your point, anyone who thinks about it hard, these rankings may not mean that much, but nevertheless, they're very popular, right?
Okay, well, so it looks like we are just about out of time here. This has been great. Everybody who's listening to this, please, I guess one of the key points I just want to make here is that this is really complicated and I can't make a blanket recommendation to any of you listening, but I want to make one, which is please don't attempt to do this by yourself, okay? And these gentlemen, as you can see, are obviously very credible resources. Their contact information is going to be in the show notes, but there are a lot of different ways that you can get guidance and advice on this. So just please consider consider the risks of going it alone. And I think this is not a time to be brave and hope for the best if you are going to be doing some of the things or involved with some of the things we've mentioned in this podcast. What do y'all think, gentlemen?
Absolutely. If my parting words would be exactly that. And I mentioned the unfortunate enforcement side of our practice. And that's exactly what happened is, advisors tried to do it on their own. They tried to assume things. And I have to tell you, the SEC is pretty merciless. They're very, very aggressive. I know a lot of advisors wanted to get away from FINRA. And that's why they actually started down their path. But once the SEC gets into some of these smaller advisors, it's not fun.
I would agree with John, and this has, historically been a very significant area of focus for the SEC, partly because it is pretty easy to identify from their perspective when something has gone wrong, and therefore it's easy to bring an enforcement action in that case, and particularly I think the expectation now is that we are, likely to get more enforcement activity nowadays, and particularly with this rule coming into play, there's going to be a heightened focus on it. At the same time, definitely consult with your compliance consultant, your attorneys, and and your advisors. But look, I mean, there are a lot of positive things in this rule. And I'm excited to see it because I think it'll allow advisors the opportunity to compete on a level playing field like folks in other industries have historically had the opportunity to do. And as you said, Sarah, the most important, recommendation oftentimes you can get is from your clients, and now there's more freedom to do that. So.
Yeah, just to echo what Richard was saying, I think there's a lot of risk here, as John was saying, but the opportunities are enormous here if you take advantage of it. And just again, keep in mind, if you want to start taking advantage of these as soon as you can, you need to also stay in compliance with the rule at the same time. So you can't enjoy it before you're, adhering to it.
Right. Okay, well, this has been great. And I'm going to wrap here, folks, but everybody, thanks for listening. And please stay tuned for the next episode. You know, no one tells it like the badass. So please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast, everybody. And I will see you in the next one.